Okay, everybody, let's get started. Thanks for waiting. So today we're going to go through four of the readings in particular in the service of talking about today's topic, the teaching hospital and the laboratory. If you want to get the four readings out, we're going to be talking about our primarily, first and foremost, Jewson's article, The Disappearance of the Sick Man from Medical Cosmology. And then I'm going to have us turn towards looking at the story by Nathaniel Hawthorne, as well as the short article I had you read on the Flexner Report, and then the speech by William Osler read for today. So let's start with the Norman Jewson article. All right, so what I want to break down for today and talk about is really the way that we've been talking a couple of weeks now, post-Paris medicine, with the rise of different forms of empirical sort of science, in particular with the rise of the experimental method and its place in clinical practice and clinical discourse, how these spaces become sites of contention, and not just sites of contention, but sites of concentration, if you will, of clinical and medical authority. Foucault has talked a lot about the Berkeley Clinic, has talked a lot about gazes and ways of seeing. Seeing and knowing is what Foucault talks about. Well, this Jewson article is supposed to help us realize that it's not just the way we look at patients or the way that we actually gaze at them that becomes a defining feature in how we can change the historiography of medicine, but really where we're doing that looking. What kind of discourse is happening, what kind of places in many ways can determine a good way of providing a summation if major changes that are happening in medicine, in the 19th century in particular. So turning to Jewson's article, he basically, in the introduction, outlines what the article is going to be about. And it's basically 5 points. We're just going to kind of go through each of those to get a sense about what his philosophy is, his theory of it on medical history would be. In the first paragraph, it's called Introduction, then. It starts by mentioning in about the fourth line, firstly, the notion of medical cosmology. That's what's going to be talked about. Now, we've been talking about medical cosmologies semester long, but we're going to look in a second on what he means by that. Secondly, modes of production of knowledge. Thirdly, the types of medical cosmology that he's interested in. Fourthly, the difference between person and object-oriented method of medicine, which is a bit what Foucault talked about. And then lastly, what are these terms, bedside medicine, hospital medicine, laboratory medicine, what we're going to talk about. So let's take the first category. He talks about medical cosmology, which is on the next page. And some of this is going to seem like slightly overview, but it's a good overview to have us think about what are the topics we're talking about today, these two spaces, but how does this shade, in some ways, a lot of the stuff we've looked at in weeks prior? So here we mention, if you look at the bottom of the first paragraph on this page, cosmologies are not only ways of seeing, but also ways of not seeing. Cosmologies prescribe the visible and the invisible, the imaginable and the inconceivable. They exclude in the same moment as they include. Or as he'll say in the next sentence, states of knowledge and ignorance and ways of knowing and ignoring. To that end, when we talk about cosmologies, and in the historical general sense when we say cosmology, what we mean, if you want to write this to the side, is just worldview. How do we see the world? How do we see the world interacting? What is our sense of the mortal and the immortal? What do we see as significant or not, grave or not? How do we actually know something? Whether on experience or on faith, based on learning or based on shorthand. To that degree, medical cosmologies are significant for Jewson because what he's trying to say to us is that how we view not just our bodies and our health and our own mortality, how that is significant is how it's reflected in the endowment we give to the constructions of medicine to some degree. Or as he says here in the paragraph, it's just below where the italics are. They function as a medium within and through which perceptions of self and of others are expressed, legitimized, and institutionalized. Those are sort of the big three words that we're talking about here. We're talking about not just in the history of medicine, but this week in particular. How are they expressed, or where are they expressed? How are they legitimized, or where are they legitimized? And how are they institutionalized? Quite literally, where are they institutionalized? So what are the differences about thinking about a hospital or a laboratory or a certain space as defining what constitutes for us reliable, authentic sort of scientific, clinical, or medical knowledge? Turn the page, if you could, because I want to just kind of jump right to how he breaks down these three different cosmologies. What I want to do is look at the prose he gives us first in the different sections, and feel free to chime in here. And then after looking at some of the prose, how he breaks down bedside, hospital, and laboratory medicine, I'm going to have us turn towards that chart that he provides for us on page 228, and it's very like a sociologist to provide for us a chart breakdown, if you will, of this theory. So this is on page 227 for bedside medicine. Two words I want you to take note of, first of all, are these words that he uses, polycentric and polymorphous. It's about three lines down. This becomes important because, well, we talk about an era of bedside medicine, and it's a kind of dubious, strange sort of term, what constitutes bedside medicine, is a definition that is multicentric or polycentric, as he says, or multimorphous or polymorphous, if you will. To that degree, it's not as fixed as a concept. So in looking at bedside, hospital, and laboratory medicine, we can already see in that breakdown that why he would think of the first one as being polymorphous in some degrees, or in some ways polycentric, makes sense, because compared to a hospital, laboratory, a bedside doesn't seem to be as fixed of a space in terms of our definition of four walls in a specific space or a building to that degree. Bedside medicine, as all of these are places as much as they are concepts. Now here's how he describes bedside medicine. This is the second paragraph that's under three types of cosmology. He says, the vision of the sick man, institutionalized within the tenets of bedside medicine, was that of a conscious human totality. A viewpoint that transcended, not merely united, the distinctions of psyche and soma found in modern medicine. The two major growth points of bedside medicine were phenomenological nosology and speculative pathology. Both activities generated a large number of often mutually contradictory theories, and as a result, medical knowledge constituted a chaotic diversity of schools of thought. The definition of the field was diffuse and problematic, disciplinary boundaries weak and amorphous. The fundamental premises of the subject were a matter of dispute and debate. Rivalry between the proponents of the various theories was commonly conducted at the level of personal abuse and dogmatic polemic. Now, which is to say that this sounds like it's a rather scathing portrait or critique of bedside medicine, but actually embedded in Jussen's language here are actually lots of liberating, actually positive sort of assessments of this particular category of what constitutes the bedside. So, we can describe the bedside medicine for him then, as we said, as polycentric. Polymorphous, is that what he says?
Polymorphous. Could you define the terms?
Sure. So polycentric would mean with many centers. There isn't a unified, a distinct, a unanimous sort of center for medicine, if you will. And that makes sense, right? Because if we're saying hospital medicine is different, then hospital medicine has a place, we can say that hospital is the center of medicine, or that laboratory is the place that defines. Bedside is to suggest that any bedside potentially could be. So it's a much loosey-goosey kind of what he means by polycentric. Polymorphous means also the sense that it's malleable. It has a kind of non-fixedness. Because don't forget, to define something as a hospital or a laboratory requires a degree of authentication on the part of some sort of institution to that degree. I mean, how hard is it to deem something bedside or to name something one's bed? I mean, that's something that seems to require a lower threshold in terms of what we constitute as its official definition or category. So for him, polycentric and polymorphous mean the sense that it's malleable. It's not quite so self-determined in its categorical imperative. To that degree, the important parts he mentions in this paragraph are this sense of the conscious human totality, is what he talks about. Now, when we're talking about bedside medicine, this is very much, if you want to key this up with our other readings, thinking about this being the moment here of really when Paris medicine starts to come in. Now, Paris medicine isn't what creates the hospital. Paris medicine is the moment that starts to think of the hospital as the locus, if you will, of where medical and clinical innovation, training, and practice, and healing can happen. So before that is when we're talking about this period that is of a conscious human totality. We've talked about this a lot this semester, this idea that we're thinking more about the idea, whether through the humoral theory or some other medical cosmology, of thinking about individuals in totem. If Foucault says in The Birth of the Clinic that the question changed with the rise of hospital medicine from what is wrong with you to where it hurts, bedside medicine is the stage of what is wrong with you. That stage is the stage of the conscious human totality. And that's why there's a similar kind of polymorphous, kind of loosey-goosey sort of question of what constitutes bedside medicine. So that's one reason. The second thing that's important here that he mentions about bedside medicine is this emphasis on phenomenological nosology. And by that nosological definition, we mean categorization based on at experience level what's phenomenological. To that degree, what that means is less being wedded toward institutional sort of definition of how we categorize illness or disease, but rather how we experience it with an individual in totality. Therefore, the pathology is a speculative form of pathology. Or as he says here, the definition of the field was diffuse and problematic. Disciplinary boundaries were weak and amorphous. Now, those words problematic and weak sound like they're a critique of this moment, which in some ways they are. It's what gave rise to Paris medicine and the hospital as a central space, because it was an attempt to try to make not diffuse, not different, not distinct, if you will, from different persons, what could be the unified definition of a particular pathology or a particular diagnosis. Now, the point about that is it sounds like a critique. But Jussen's point is actually within each of these stages, there's actually great liberties too. So if bedside medicine is polycentric and polymorphous, if he says it could be problematic and weak boundaries, all of these also mean that they could be potentially very empowering things for a patient at this particular time. So that if there's no unified center where your diagnosis has to happen or your consultation has to happen, if there's no distinct way in which that consultation has to look like, and that there is no set way of what those boundaries might be, problematic or weak as they might be, that also means that what that is about the clinical exchange is that it's also more negotiable, is how we would describe this phase. So Jussen, as a sociologist, is noting in the past, sometimes with critique, but sometimes also with a bit of rose-tinted glasses, what was good at the time of bedside medicine. One of the things that was good was the fact that in its very polyamorphous sort of state, it could be actually a state in which there was a lot of liberty, there was a lot of freedom. This is the stage with which we talk about, I've used the phrase most often, the medical marketplace. Now, we're living in a medical marketplace always, but we use that term so often, pre-Paris medicine, in the 18th centuries and prior, because it's a time when we did talk about medicine as being much more upon a burden of what is the reciprocal sort of relationship, if you will, between a clinician and a patient. And to that degree, it's one where there is a kind of struggle, if you will, for power. Yeah.
Is that sort of leading in then, though you say it's a critique, but it's actually a good thing, like in the Flexner piece where they talk about how all these rural areas lost all that stuff, because so it's sort of a critique, and we think we're doing this good thing, but yet at the same time, you lose bedside, you also lose like a rural clinic with.
You do, and that's why this assessment on Jussen's part is really one. This is why we're doing good historiography here, because this assessment is one that's about 1770 to 1870 are the dates he gives us. It's before Paris medicine, in the midst of Paris medicine, and just after Paris medicine, where he's seen the different stages. But it's absolutely a critique of this article that was written in, is that right, the year when it was written? The printout, does it stand in front there? 70-something, I think it is?
76.
76, is that right? Yeah, which is to say this is also a product of its time, too, after the Flexner Report, in which it's also saying, well, what are the things that were actually advantageous that could have been in these different stages? Yeah?
Wasn't this also, don't you see, the emphasis of the narrative as you go through this, which then is the code of the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that movement towards a more holistic form of medicine, or return to holism, as we call it in the 20th century, or an embracement of narrative in medicine, or a return towards bedside manner in clinical practice and clinical training, is mindful of this very trajectory. And what that is a mindfulness of is that this movement that we're talking about here from bedside to hospital laboratory absolutely made less problematic, less weak, the boundaries, made more uniform, the standard, and actually improved, statistically as we consider it, the efficacy, the success rates of medical practice and training as it was happening. But this assessment is about, well, what was lost also in that process too. And just as you saw in the Flexner Report article, there was great, with its uniformities, great changes and improvements in medical school education, but there were some things lost too. And this trajectory is a mindfulness of some of those losses. That's why I say this paragraph from Jussen sounds like it's a scathing critique, but it's a critique, and a warranted one, but one that also says, well, better how? In what ways was it better to some degree? Let's turn the page real quick. I want to read one more paragraph on bedside medicine. This is on page 229. It's a paragraph he has here that's about medical metaphors and cosmologies. The first full paragraph on 229. Medical cosmologies are frequently expressed in the form of metaphors or analogies, which enable their holders to explain bodily events by treating them as if they were of the same order as other phenomena with which they are already familiar. This foundation of metaphor may become part of the everyday, taken for granted currency of social exchange, and in the process of socialization and interaction, come to be seen as an objective description of the ultimate realities of the medical world. In the era of bedside medicine, cosmological analogies emphasize an image of the body as a microcosm, a reality sui generis, thank you, subject to its own peculiar laws of growth and decay, comparable to the macrocosm of the physical universe. Now, one thing to note here, as many theorists and narrative theorists have accounted for, metaphors are not distinct to a particular historical moment. They're something we lean on in general in talking about medical interactions or interactions in general. The point of juice in here is that metaphors were the central sort of currency, if you will, of how to discuss with the patient. Let's embrace that kind of metaphorical understanding of your own illness. One, in terms of rendering more germane the discussion that was happening about clinical matters, because it's important to have the patient involved and interactive in this process. And two, because prior to Paris medicine, as we know, leaning a lot on classical medicine, the actual medical theories themselves were cosmological and metaphorical in nature. So when we talked about the humors, the way in which they saw the world as a mirror for the body, or the humors as a mirror for this, the elements in nature, so to speak, was an attempt both in germane practice and also in theoretical principle to create a kind of union, if you will, between the metaphorical large and the specific, which is the body, if you will. So when you think about that John Donne piece we talked about, where he talks about the doctor is sent for, and my body is like the world, and it's bigger than the world, that kind of analogy, the significance of it is that it's not unique. In fact, it was the standard of its time, and it's the standard of its time because it renders more approachable, more digestible, and more acceptable, because that's also the standard of how medical discourse within the profession, not just outside of it, sort of works. And why that's significant in terms of location is this also. The bedside becomes important at this question of thinking about agency, clinical agency in this particular moment, because it's a medical marketplace, as we've talked about, where a clinician, as a physician, or a surgeon, or a barber surgeon, or apothecary is going, the patient, or the sick man, as Juicen would have us call the person in this era, has a higher likelihood of being satisfied or dissatisfied with the clinician and moving on to somebody else. Juicen's point is that it's not made possible just by the capitalistic tendencies of the medical marketplace, and not just by the cosmological or metaphorical sort of implications of the discourse of the time, but by the very stakes of location, the central part of his thesis. And the reason being this. Bedside medicine, in the way that it suggests that medicine didn't have to happen at your bedside at home. We tend to say bedside medicine and think it means a doctor is sent for, or home visit sort of happens. That's sometimes how it happened. People still went to clinics and hospitals and stuff before Paris medicine, but the idea was that it was not unusual for a doctor to come to you or for bedside visitation to be the central part of your interaction with the clinician. But what that suggests, that it was not just a possibility, but in fact highly probable, was the fact that medical encounters quite often happened on your own turf. You had a sense of greater confidence or greater ease, or at least a sense of not being as disempowered because of the fact that the medical encounter could happen at your very bedside. So in that term that Juicen has created for us, he's saying that one of the things that changes is the stakes with which patients or sick men and women can feel as though they have a sense of a foothold within the clinical sort of encounter. And hospital medicine comes in after this. Hospital medicine is this moment that we know, for all number of reasons, political, economical, pedagogical, in terms of teaching and training, organizational, improving the standardization, improving the efficacy and the dissemination of clinical practice. We've used the hospital now, the end of the 18th, the beginning of the 19th century, to be the locus, the place that we're going to house all of clinical practice. We're going to take some of those hospitals that have existed before, those l'hôpital général, as Foucault calls them, or the Hôtel Dieu, but we're going to make them, instead of sort of supplementary satellites in a country, the big places where medicine happens. It's where we're going to train our doctors. It's where we're going to go if you're sick. It's where you're going to go to have your baby delivered. It's where you're going to go to die. It's where you're going to go to get a diagnosis. It might even be go where you get your prescription filled. The centrality of that location is supposed to improve efficacy and standardization, fix these problems, but as we'll see, according to Juicen, it takes us off one person's turf and moves us to another, is sort of his point about this particular moment. We're going to get to the teaching hospital in a moment, because the teaching hospital is a small facet of Paris medicine, but it becomes the most important feature of medical practice in the 20th century in German, later American models of medical schools. To that degree, it becomes another way which we think about the turf on which training or clinical encounters happening is actually being the most important part of how we think about the breakdown of clinical practice. So let's look at what he has to say about hospital medicine. This is on page 229. And I'm going to read at length a little bit from here, so feel free to interrupt me or ask a question after I finish. This is the two paragraphs that are at the bottom of 229. A dramatic transformation in the form of medical cosmology occurred at the Parisian hospital schools during the first three or four decades of the 19th century, with the introduction of a new mode of production of medical knowledge, here termed hospital medicine, elsewhere often termed Paris medicine. The raw materials of medical theorizing now became the innumerable morbid events occurring within the gross anatomical structures, which presented themselves to the clinical gaze on the crowded wards. Medical investigators concentrated upon the accurate diagnosis and classification of cases, rather than upon the prognosis and therapy of symptom complexes. The sick man became a collection of synchronized organs, each with a specialized function. Now, we've talked about this in the last couple of weeks, in different moments where Paris medicine rendered possible this unified vision of different forms of anatomy and biology, but also in that process then seeing the individual as a collection of organs, tissues, systems, cells, and in some cases when they're sick, diseases, viruses, and bacteria as well. And that kind of systematization, that kind of breakdown of the perception of the individual is for Jussen, like it was for Foucault, a different way of seeing, if not the totality of the individual, certainly the accumulation of different things that can make up a clinical subject, if you will. This really is the moment where we're starting to see the disappearance of the sick man, if you will. Notice that shift from sick man to patient. If we can see changes, one, we talked a bit before about why the term patient is problematic. It assumes that one does not have an identity as an individual in the medical world until you have a relationship with some kind of clinician. After all, the term patient doesn't really mean anything without its counterpart. But you can certainly be sick or infirmed or part of the medical world without being a patient. So the sick man, for Jussen, is a testament to this stage. And the patient is born at this moment. With the birth of the clinic is the birth of the patient. One has subjecthood, one has citizenship within the medical world and the rise of the hospital when one is a patient. Now, as we can see here, one of the things that's also changing is that when we take away the person as a sick man, even in its very term, sick man, we're acknowledging an individual being. A patient tends to suggest to some degree that we have some keyhole with which we can identify how this person has viability as a subject. Patient? Well, patient of what? What is your here for? Yeah, question?
I was just going to say, I work with a lot of mental health community centers and would spend hours trying to figure out what to call patient/client.
Client, in other words,
gives you an elevated status because then you have more control, but it's not as elevated in some senses.
It's true. In a lot of contexts, we use the word client a lot also because we think of it as more humane. I'll give you an example. I've done a lot of, exactly, and I've done a lot of work in the past working with developmentally disabled people, people who have Down syndrome or what we used to call mental retardations, what have you. And on the one hand, you could think of them as patients, but they quite often get called clients. I think because it's supposed to empower in some way. And yet, like patient, though, it does have within it set up, one is not a citizen within the discourse until you're a client of somebody else or a patient of somebody else. Yeah.
But the Osler in his essay, Physician and Patient, talks about why you call somebody a patient. He said that when someone becomes a patient, the physician has an obligation to them. And client seems to sort of remove that obligation.
Yeah. In fact, the value of the word patient and why it becomes a cornerstone for Osler and physicians even before him is the way that it imbues a sense of duty, if you will, to the individual. So it's not that the term exists nefariously or without any good intention, but Jussen's point is the fact that even if it exists as a kind of like term that can absolutely imbue a kind of duty that one has to the patient, it also has loaded within it a sense of what's the precursor for even getting that label at all. You know what I mean? So in that sense, Osler's argument would be that I choose to call them that because it speaks to the kind of relationship I have with them and the kind of respect I have for them as my particular interactors, if you will. But the point of someone like Jussen would be, and so what do you call them before they even saw you then? What's the term that they get to have then? So that's the sort of acknowledgement that's supposed to be made there. Let's look at the second paragraph here that breaks down nicely the sort of distinctions that we've talked about with Paris medicine and Foucault, and also what this hospital medicine phase looks like. There are four great innovations of hospital medicine, and these were structural nosology, as opposed to what was on the last page, boo-boo, as opposed to phenomenological nosology, localized pathology, as opposed to speculative pathology. And you notice with both of these, structural and localized, we're getting to these, let's look more specifically at tissues, at systems, at organs, at cells, that kind of gaze. Physical examination, which we know in hospital medicine was the definite movement with which clinicians moved much more towards physical examination, and as we have seen with experimental method, and Claude Bernard in particular, the movement towards statistical analysis. So we can see here that one, and this is one of the phrases that Bernard would use, that hospital medicine allows medicine to become more technical, more practical, more precise, and the word he would use is more scientific, because now it's concerned with structures, localizations, physical factors, experiences, and empirical sort of evidence, and statistical sort of analysis. The major achievement of the Paris School was the delineation of objective disease entities by means of correlating external symptoms with internal lesions. Pathology took the form of a local solidarism, focusing upon specific morbid events within the tissues rather than upon general disturbances of the constitutional system as a whole, aka it took a more concerted, specific, and viable interest in what specifically is happening internally or externally at the level of a specific tissue, wound, problem, disease, than what one symptom meant about the totality of the whole of the individual. In other words, the next sentence, symptoms were demoted, taken down, from the status of defining characteristics to that of secondary indicators of disease. Now the distinction he's saying then is, one could euphemistically say that we've gone from treating the symptom to now treating the disease is one way that hospital medicine has changed things. But also, it's that the symptom becomes less important, which is interesting, because we think that Foucault says, and he does say, it goes from what's wrong with you to where does it hurt. We think that we're actually giving more investment to the symptom, more investment to the wound, the isolated problem, if you will. But the point is actually this, we focus more in hospital medicine, our gaze is more directed at the precise site of wound or injury or problem, but only so that we can see what it stands for, not what it is. So that we can see that symptom is representative of, well, the reason you have this particular problem here, these particular growths, is because of the fact that you have herpes or some other illness, not because of the injury or the wound itself is the problem at hand. To that degree, the precision that's happening here is also one that allows us to move beyond just symptoms. Yeah.
Is that also one of the take-home messages from the Cunningham bit about transforming plague? That's that idea of changing the locus of disease from symptoms to something concrete or observable.
Absolutely. In the case of that Cunningham piece, it's about taking it to the next place, the laboratory and individual, which is to say laboratory medicine, which we're going to get to in just a second, makes possible the fact that if I need to look at the entirety of you, and I'm going to do it maybe on your turf, to I'm going to look at something more specific from you, probably on my turf, I'm now going to take it to, I'm going to actually look at that very specific thing of you, divorced sometimes even from you. So I now want to look at it under a microscope or in a laboratory or someplace else, and I don't even really need you, I just need that thing itself, and I can take it to a different location. Reading the rest of this paragraph, it says, the surface appearances were made subservient to the hidden underlying causes. Diagnoses were founded upon physical examination of observable organic structures rather than verbal analysis of subjectively defined sensations and feelings. This was achieved during life by means of a number of specifically invented scopes, laparoscopes, microscopes, stethoscopes, and after death by means of autopsy. And we have seen that these are the cornerstone tools about how the clinical gaze gets endowed, not just by learning and seeing, but by using instruments and using one's knowledge from autopsy, absolutely. Pathological anatomy, indeed, became the all-pervading research technique of hospital medicine. So it's a different form and a different way of looking at pathology. It's his reference to rather than verbal analysis of subjectively defined sensations and feelings that's really the cornerstone here. For if bedside medicine for Jewson is important because it constitutes a medical marketplace, which gives some agency in terms of dollars talk, I'm going to walk, that sort of thing, right? If they suggest a greater degree of patient or sick man agency at the level of it can be on your own turf, it's because he sees an era of bedside medicine as being a time when a patient has more discourse, discussion, exchange with a clinician. A clinician can ask, what's wrong with you? Say, this is what I think. And the clinicians say, I think it might be this. And I could say, well, I'm not so sure it's that. And the clinicians say, well, let's try something else. there's a kind of exchange back and forth that maybe is idealized by Jusen in this article and maybe a testament to when he wrote it, but it's something that he sees as significant or as a part of a feature. Hospital medicine is a time where discussion is less important. Or as we say with Foucault and his talking about the clinical gaze, what you have to say is less important than what your body is saying to the clinician. So the stethoscope is such an emblematic instrument of the clinical gaze for medical theorists like me and for clinicians, because it's not that doctors stopped listening to patients, it's just they started listening differently. And they maybe weren't listening as much to what someone had to say. Well, I feel like I've got a headache and a stomach ache and that sort of thing. They'll still hear it, but that matters about this much compared to, well, let me listen to your heart, and let me hear how your breathing is, and let me see if I see anything else inside of you, and let me check some other tests. Let me listen to those things, because those things will affect what you have to say about how you're feeling in general. So it's a change in terms of what that kind of voice is. Of course, now in the 20th century, beyond the dawn of the 21st century, we long for bedside medicine because we want to forget that we don't want to hear from patients. Not at the expense of getting rid of those tests and stethoscopes and other forms of learning. It's just that it seemed that the pendulum really went the other way, from listening entirely to what the patient had to say in words, in discussion, in conversation, to almost listening not at all, and instead listening to what the body and tests had to say, and scopes and information sort of gave us, to us now trying to find someplace in between. And let's see what laboratory medicine is. This is on the next paragraph on 230. Laboratory medicine was first established within the German university system in the middle decades of the 19th century. This is going to get to what today is about, these two moments. The transformation in cosmology precipitated by this innovation was founded upon the application of the concepts and methods of natural science to the solution of medical problems. The two major areas of development were histology and physiology, which we talked about last week. Numerous discoveries concerning the properties of tissues were organized into a coherent synthesis by the cell theory. The latter proposed that the ultimate structural and developmental units of all living animals and plants are the cells. Following the announcement of this theory, intensive studies were made of the processes of cellular function and reproduction. Progress in physiology was largely the result of the deliberate introduction of theories and techniques of physics into the study of living organisms, pioneered by a small group of young scientists at the University of Berlin. To the next paragraph, pathology also was totally reconstituted. It was asserted that observational anatomy would never explain the causes of disease. Hence, the new pathology was built upon the findings of experimental physiology. Since the cell was the fundamental unit of life, then it must also be the locus of disease. So now we've moved then from the turf being one bedside, the turf being the hospital or the clinic as the site of centrality, to the laboratories being the place. Now, what's significant here is that the hospital absolutely does, according to Jusen, to some degree replace the bedside as a central location. But I don't think he would argue that the laboratory replaces the hospital. It's just that the laboratory becomes more important in what it does that the hospital used to do alone. And what that it can mean then is the way it looks, the way it determines the pathology, the way that it can figure out the diagnosis of an individual. In fact, it's that site of diagnosis, if you want to write that down, is the major change that Jusen is talking about here. If clinical encounters are changing in 1,000 different ways during Paris medicine, and I've harped on it in all the readings we have, they've changed in terms of where you go to med school, where you give birth to your baby, where you wait in the lobby, where you get your medicines, where you might be died, where an autopsy might be done on you. The clinic is supposed to house all of these things now. Jusen, I think, in my theory, is he's really concerned with where do you get diagnosed is the most central location for where we can say agency is happening in clinical discourse. Is it happening at home, at bedside? Is it happening in the hospital, or is it happening in the laboratory? And the point for him is the fact that it might change significantly, not just where those moments are happening, where that pathology and where that diagnosis is happening, but how close to it as a sick man or a patient you might be. Turn to page 237. He articulates this pretty well in this article. This is the first full paragraph on page 237. A new phase in the emergence of an object-oriented cosmology opened with the development of laboratory medicine. Two major aspects of laboratory medicine will be discussed here. Firstly, whereas under hospital medicine, the direction of the power differential between the sick and medical personnel had been reversed, under laboratory medicine, the patient was removed from the medical investigator's field of saliency altogether. This increase in the social distance between the sick and medical investigators was accompanied by a relocation of the fundamental realities of pathology and microscopical events beyond the tangible detection of patients and practitioners alike. Secondly, whereas hospital medicine had celebrated the interests and perceptions of clinicians, laboratory medicine was founded upon the worldview of the scientific research worker. This transformation precipitated a total reconstruction of the epistemological foundations of medicine as a field of knowledge. Now, here's the big point about these two things he's saying. One is this. One is the fact that it changed the amount of exchange that happened between a clinician and a patient. And laboratory medicine, for him, totally blew this out of the water. He talks about bedside medicine as being in one direction, and hospital medicine as sometimes being in a different, in the way that doctors and patients talk to one another. But it's this site of diagnosis that I harp on, because what it's saying is that if bedside medicine suggests you can be diagnosed on your own turf and in conversation with a clinician, if hospital medicine says you're going to be diagnosed on his turf or her turf, and quite often less in conversation, laboratory medicine suggests you're not going to be on the turf at all, most likely. In fact, it's not going to be by your bed at home in bedside medicine, and it's not going to be in the clinic. In fact, you're going to be waiting here for the test results, and they're going to be done down the hall, or in the hospital across town, or six time zones away with somebody else, or some lab out in Schenectady someplace, I don't know. It's this idea that now you're not even within earshot anymore. So if you felt like you were a part of the conversation and less of a part of a conversation, Juicin's point about laboratory medicine is conversation, you ain't got nothing to do with that. In fact, you can't even hear it, you're so far away from it. To that degree, and this is a generalization, but to that degree, for him, it sets up a question about what does that suggest, not about our own personhood in the clinic, but our own proximity to our own diagnoses. And for him, that's a significant shift and change. Now, we are improving these problematic and weak sort of moments that are happening here even ever more so as you move towards laboratory medicine. So I don't think Juicin bemoans that, nor should we in modern medical practice as it happens. But in addition to losing the location as a site of power or agency or comfort for a patient in a particular moment, we're also losing the proximity that a patient or a sick person can have towards their own clinical personhood, if you will. Any questions? Yes?
Well, I understand where the perspective, where the site is migrating, you know, from bedside down to the laboratory. And there seems to me a very firm distinction between bedside and hospital, mm-hmm. much less firm between laboratory and hospital.
Yeah.
It would seem on two accounts. One is that the laboratory really is possible only as you can understand the cell better and understand tissues better.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a technology that's necessary to get to the stage of thinking laboratory medicine. But the core problem for me is that you still have sick people. You still have people in need mm-hmm. of some therapy.
Yeah.
And even if that's not a primary interest to the diagnostician, mm-hmm. you still got people who need something. And it's still got to be administered to them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever they find in the lab, it's got to be translated back up to the person who presented to begin with.
Yeah.
So I think what's key to it is what you said before, and that the hospital center doesn't cease to exist.
Right.
It's just paired with the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right way to think about
it? I think so, and that's why I give that sort of caveat about Juicin's. If he says we've moved from the hospital to the laboratory, I always think, well, not entirely, you know, and that's why I harp on the question about diagnosis, because I think it is about the sense of what part of clinical practice, not clinical practice in its entirety, that changes location or changes methodology to that degree. To that end, the results from the laboratory are actually supposed to filter back to the hospital. We haven't gotten rid of the clinic as a space of disseminating and treating individuals. But yet, there's something powerful that used to happen in the clinic, in the ward, that is now being placed someplace else, in the hands, according to Juicin, sometimes of somebody else, some other form of technician. And I think the point is of some other form of viewership or spectatorship. And for him, that translates into a disparity also in proximity. But I think you're right, yeah.
So one of the corollaries to that, I mean, there's a little bit of reading about vivisection, particularly the reaction against it in the mid-19th century in Germany, which was very strong,
mm-hmm.
both pro and con. And those that were reacting against it were saying that it was searching for a tissue explanation, a physiologic explanation, with no tie back to therapy. So at least to the lay reader, and there were many laymen, lay intellectuals, non-leukemia mm-hmm. intellectuals, who called out against vivisection on philosophical principles. But one of those principles seemed to be that, at least to the lay public, they saw, as it got into a real frenzy, of, you know, experimenting almost for experiment's sake, they saw no tie back to therapy. Is that eventually what causes laboratory medicine to be attenuated to some extent, or is that not?
It actually speaks to the first question you asked, the first one being about, well, doesn't laboratory medicine have to go back to the clinic eventually? And the point is that it can, but it doesn't have to. So that there would be endowed in this era of laboratory medicine, this era that really is the dawn of what the experimental method that we talked about with Claude Bernard, this idea that you can learn a lot in medicine, as it's now being called, by putting into practice scientific and experimental method that may not result in the improvement of the patient status of one individual back at the clinic. It could be some sort of experiment or work that's being done in the laboratory. And the difference is that those kinds of experiments have been happening long before, but either they were frowned upon, or they were not integrated into clinical practice because they weren't in the hospital, or because they weren't considered central because they didn't deal with actual patient care. But the other major thing, too, is because they weren't in the service of daily clinical practice. To have a scientific form of inquiry that is somatic, biological, even sort of health-related, would have been in the service of now medicine as it's understood. This is why he focuses on cosmologies. And this worldview, to do work in the laboratory, is in the service of medicine, even if it's not in the service of a particular patient. So this is why I think you see at that time those debates about the vivisection that are coming up, not just because of the fact that people are embracing experimental and animal experimental methods now more than they had in centuries, or now because of the fact that they couldn't have those debates centuries prior, but because of the fact that, well, if you're going to do something in the service of medicine, it doesn't have to be in the service of a particular patient, then balls to the wall, let's go for this too as well.
Yeah.
Dick? I have trouble with this conclusion on because it talks about the changes, but when you go back, I mean, Bruce Osler is the old archetype. It's more of a delusion than it is a supplanting. Like Osler's, two of his most famous aphorisms are, what he said, if you listen to the patient long enough, they'll tell you what's wrong with them. He also said that if you see a patient without studying the disease, it's like sailing on chart at sea. But if you study the disease without seeing the patients, like never going to see at all. There was still an emphasis. I mean, I think the supplanting of the narrative and the really a post World War II phenomenon. People were still much more. It was really a respect for all three, the hospital and the bedside manners as well as the laboratory that worked together.
Yeah.
And only when we began to get much more technical in post World War II, I think they really supplanted the bedside.
Well, it's hard because on the one hand, first of all, Osler's a hard example to mention because he's just sort of the ideal, most humane sort of like doctor you can think of. So he is going to have a perspective and a mindfulness that we know is exceptional, maybe rather than standardized for what would have been clinical practice. But I think your point too about the way in which how significant does the laboratory get, how much do we invest in the site of power in terms of diagnosis, it absolutely explodes the second half of the 20th century because we get that much more sophisticated in what we can do in the laboratory. And I think Justin's point is the fact that what we're seeing here are hints of this kind of movement, this kind of shift, maybe then rather absolute sort of like trajectorial sort of changes, if you will. To that end, the laboratory doesn't get rid of the hospital, and the hospital doesn't get rid of the bedside, and none of this really gets rid of the individual. But what it suggests is gestures towards, movement towards thinking about how do we prioritize these things. So to that degree, laboratory medicine, hospital medicine, bedside medicine, this kind of rubric is really helpful in the way that it thinks, what do we authenticate with the greatest degree of sort of like respect, maybe, than rather what do we actually lean on or rely on. So Osler's suggestions are absolutely true, and any physician would have probably scoffed at this at the time that we're talking about patients all the time sort of thing. But it's the way in which how we've reorganized is, for him, symptomatic of how we've changed the cosmology a little bit in medicine as a larger sort of swath. And of course, this is scholarship like this is always a generalization, and when it's done by a sociologist, it is definitely a generalization. You know, sociologists will generalize like nobody will, so we definitely take this with a grain of salt. But nevertheless, the generalization gives us a good foothold, I think, of the kinds of stakes we're supposed to have here. I want to direct you to one more thing in this article. This is on page 231. It's this breakdown that he gives between what he calls object-oriented and person-oriented cosmologies. And this is just another sort of like bifurcation, a breakdown, a binary, if you will, of what this triptych is setting up here. The object versus person-oriented thing is another way of saying how do we humanize or dehumanize patients or sick persons in the medical realm. How do we look at the totality or non-totality of individuals? How do we consider the whole of an individual, their humanity, versus how do we consider something more symptomatic and isolated? Again, it sounds like one sounds better than the other. If you went to a patient in the hospital today and you said, name, age, sex. Okay, would you like me to use person-oriented language with you or object-oriented language? I think I'll go with person. It sounds like one is clearly better. I think the point here about Juicin is really the fact that they're both valuable ways of which to do clinical practice. And the hard part is the fact that we can see an overemphasis or a movement of that pendulum towards one form or another or kind of cosmology. So it's not that bedside medicine is better than hospital medicine or laboratory medicine, or that a person-oriented or an object orientation is inherently better. After all, I can go to a clinic and see a really good doctor who's really nice to me, and I can get a home visit at bedside, and that person could be a real asshole, you know? So going to one space doesn't determine the quality of the care one gets from her physician or clinician. But having said that, knowing the places, the spaces, and the forms of looking, and the question of whether someone is being person or object oriented, knowing that language helps us, I think, better to calibrate how we're assessing the efficacy of medicines that's happening. At the end of the day, Juicin himself, as I told you all semester long in the history of science and medicine, we absolutely know that medicine and science is getting more advanced and complicated, but it's hard as a historian because we want to think that, you know, things are improving, but we're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to, as historians, think that we're at the apex of culture. A system like this, or a system like person and object oriented, is to tell us, in spite of the fact that we know success rates for cancer treatment are better now than ever, in spite of the fact that we can diagnose things better than ever before, in spite of the fact that the laboratory is a zillion times better than it was even 50 or 1,000 years ago, right? Those things tell us then that in spite of those facts, we can still think, but how is it different? Or how is it better or not better in certain ways? And to use this kind of language is a helpful sort of tool for that. And it sets us up for what is this period we're talking about today, when the laboratory and the hospital have already been, in the beginning of the 19th century, seen as the great innovative fields with which we're supposed to change clinical practice and clinical theory. How so in the 20th century, where they absolutely become that? The laboratory, as Dick said, becoming a space where if the laboratory was important in the late 19th century, by God, it was important in the 20th century. We know that. We know that today whenever we go to a doctor's office for tests. And if the hospital was the cornerstone of Paris medicine at the beginning of the 19th century, we look at this speech by Osler, we look at the way med schools are worked right now, we know the hospital is important as ever than it was before. So in that, those stakes, how can we assess the 20th century practice and the 21st century practice of the laboratory and the hospital, bearing in mind this 19th century investment shift or overinvestment in certain spaces?
A quick practical question. In the 19th century, when the laboratories came into existence, I know they were tied to universities, they had to be. Were they affiliated with the hospitals, or were they entirely separate from the hospitals?
Well, that's hard, and they weren't always affiliated with universities either. They were affiliated with science, or they are affiliated with just more generally experimental method. So that a laboratory would have been an important space, either what it was connected to, practically, technically, if it was attached to a hospital or a university or something, and most often it was likely a university rather than a hospital, whether it was attached to a particular kind of methodology, was it scientific, was it alchemical, was it something that was trying to attach to a particular kind of instrument or tool that was being used, and the last part would have been what instrument itself was the cornerstone. So one could easily turn one's geology workshop in one's house into a laboratory by, I have a microscope now, or I work with chemicals in order to test those stones or what have you. An important thing about the laboratory, if you want to know in the long sense, is one is how it changes, one, the instruments that are used, so microscopy is intimately tied to the history of the laboratory. Two, how it changes in proximity. This space that I'm calling the laboratory, what kind of building is it in, or what kind of building is it near? And that's a very general question, but that's one way. And the third is it in a building at all? The history of the laboratory is most significant in the history of the natural sciences, because for natural history, as we know, there was no biology until the 19th century, but for natural history and the natural sciences, up until the beginning of the 19th century, the best way to do work was often to do field work, was to go out into nature and collect things and such. But the idea that you could do tests or study things of a chemical or a botanical or a biological level in a laboratory, in a space that was not in nature, that's the point of the laboratory. The laboratory studies nature, but it is not in nature. It is supposed to be a space, whether because it's clean or because it's devoid of other stimuli or variables that could affect your experimental method, it's not nature. For the longest time, the debate was, can you really learn anything about nature outside of nature? That was the big hold about the laboratory. So that it's a self-defined space is its most important thing.
I think that's useful to know.
Yeah.
I didn't get that from the article, so I mean,
this is taking it the much more sort of like technical, instrumental.
Right.
Is it someplace else within this particular building?
But we're talking about lab in the 19th century. We're talking very broadly about.
And we're talking earlier. That's why even when we look at this story, which we're going to turn to now, the birthmark by Nathaniel Hawthorne. This is a scientist who works in a laboratory, but it's basically
house.
A room in his house that's got a bunch of tools he likes to work with, and the tools he works with are potions and elixirs and daguerreotypes and photography and that kind of stuff like that. Let's actually turn to the story, because I wanted to read it because it comes from 1843, and therefore it's coming really in this moment that is probably about right here. Paris medicine has been long in place. If we tend to isolate the height of Paris medicine is the first 3 to 4 decades of the 19th century, first part of the 19th century, then 1843 is really taking us on the cusp of this movement. It's also a period when Claude Bernard has recently published his work, and therefore we know that experimental method and experimental physiology is now a cornerstone of how to not just do science, but how to do medicine. And I like this story because it's also the age of American positivism, this term. We've used that term positivism before, because of the fact that it places great emphasis on empirical method and also upon sensorial sort of experience. But now, in the middle of the 19th century, it's a period with which scientific medicine and the American sense is coming to its own right. It's important to note, by the way, that the rise of laboratory medicine is actually important for a couple of things, too, because it has a distinctive relationship with public health, which I know we just talked about. And the first is, and I say there's four main features I've written down that I think are important when we say laboratory medicine. And this is, when we say the mid-19th century, laboratory medicine. The first is laboratory diagnosis. Test results becomes important. And test results being done in a space that is better than the hospital in terms of isolating a diagnosis. The second is an emphasis on practice in isolation, is one way we put this. And that's different from quarantine, but it's an emphasis on this idea of disinfection, this idea of removing oneself from the patient interaction in order to better diagnose somebody, both to have perspective and to have the instruments and the gaze that's needed. To that end, that movement that I talk about, being away from the patient, is a cornerstone of what laboratory medicine is supposed to make possible, that perspective being better. Third is a standardization of disease. And by that sense, what we're talking about here is if we need to look more closely at what's wrong, at where does it hurt, rather than what's wrong with you, laboratory medicine is supposed to up the stakes of that particular kind of gaze, that kind of perception. And how it does it is by standardizing those very specific lesions, anomalies, test results that we need to look at, by looking at them absolutely in isolation, but in comparison with other models to see what's wrong with them. So the standardization of the disease at that moment. And then lastly, is this emphasis on technical expertise, which is again to suggest that there is clinical and medical expertise, but that technical expertise as it's rendered within the laboratory becomes a central sort of fundamental sort of principle. What's interesting about that too actually is that this story in particular by Nathaniel Hawthorne isolates for us somebody who would have been that kind of scientist and that kind of clinician who would have emphasized these particular things importantly. Diagnosis, isolation practice, the standardization of disease, a technical expertise being synonymous with one's prowess in one's particular discipline. It's also significant too because this is a period in American sort of medicine where we're seeing a distrust, if you will, of too much elitism. This is really the area of what's called Jacksonian politics, if you're familiar with that. Jacksonian politics tends to refer to this idea that we're supposed to do away with elite training, or we're supposed to do with the idea of trying to have a monopoly of things run by elite persons. So to that degree, the emphasis on technique, not just on the hospital as an institution, becomes important. So the laboratory is still a space and an endowed space and has different kinds of propensities to it, even according to Jussen. But its emphasis on technique and expertise, isolation, on really prowess and specific forms of practice is what makes it attractive to American medicine and American positivism in particular, because it at once personifies an idealization of medicine and greater technical accuracy, but also it lives up to a standard of not having to be endowed in a clinic where there's an individual that has to be sort of ruling the roost, if you will. Yeah.
I just was confused about something that you just said. Emphasis on technique and expertise, but not on elitism, so anyone could develop that?
No, it's still elitist in the sense that it's absolutely trained. It has a specialized sort of skill set that's attached to it. But if these two relationships, as Jusen say, are a struggle between the patient interacting with the clinician and being more powerful, or the patient interacting with the clinician and being less powerful. And I've said that the laboratory medicine sometimes feels difficult because it takes the patient out of the question entirely, the equation entirely. During this era in American positivism and Jacksonian politics, it would have actually been an attractive thing. Well, let's take the patient out of the equation entirely, and therefore it's not a power struggle. It's not about rendering less or more elite where the patient is. It's just, let's just look at the lesion. Let's just look at the problem. Let's do the blood test, if we will, and let that speak for itself. The very practicality, if you will, of laboratory medicine, of laboratory technique, lended to it, at that time, a feeling of being less elitist. Now, of course, in hindsight, we can certainly find some critiques of that. But I'm just saying that what was a kind of technique that really lent itself in general to movements that were happening in Western medicine at the time in America flourished dramatically in the middle of the 19th century because of that kind of suspicion towards too endowed sort of like official spaces like a hospital, so to speak. All right, let's look at the story. A couple of examples in here. So the basic tenet of the story here, this is by Nathaniel Hawthorne, who we all know, or most of us I'm sure know, from The Scarlet Letter and House of the Seven Gables, taking us all back to 11th grade, right? These stories. Now Hawthorne tends to write a lot about two different kinds of narratives. One, very contemporary narratives for him, mid-19th century narratives about New England in particular, but American ideals as they're fashioned at that particular time and how they're affected by what are considered the most current and contemporary political and sometimes even scientific ideals. He's very much concerned with how am I living in a state of great flux in terms of how people are reassessing, how Americans consider what is valuable at a particular moment. And the other kind of narrative he tends to write, like The Scarlet Letter, is one where he looks historically at America's past to try to see what were the values, puritanical or otherwise, that have shaded or affected the way that America is or isn't the democratic ideal that it thinks it is in the middle of the 19th century. The birthmark is the former. The birthmark is looking at somebody who seems to be of his age as a scientist, as an American positivist, and yet lives for a series of values that renders for Hawthorne at once the spirit of American progress and also American suspicion at the time of what could be an ideal sort of quality. I want to read for you the opening paragraph of this particular piece to get a sense about who this individual is, Elmer, as he's described for us, and then just look at a couple of moments. Now, as we know, the crux of the story is that Elmer is a scientist who works in America at this time, and he is married to Georgiana, his wife. And what will become the central crux of the plot will be what is the title of the story, which is a birthmark that his wife has, and what becomes his obsession, his desire to want to get rid of it. So this is the beginning of the story. In the latter part of the last century, there lived a man of science, an eminent proficient in every branch of natural philosophy, who not long before our story opens, had made experience of a spiritual affinity more attractive than any chemical one. He had left his laboratory to the care of an assistant, cleared his fine countenance from the furnace smoke, washed the stain of acids from his fingers, and persuaded a beautiful woman to become his wife. In those days, when the comparatively recent discovery of electricity and other kindred mysteries of nature seemed to open paths into the region of miracle, it was not unusual for the love of science to rival the love of woman in its depth and absorbing energy. The higher intellect, the imagination, the spirit, and even the heart might all find their congenial alignment, in pursuits which, as some of their ardent votaries believed, would ascend from one step of powerful intelligence to another, until the philosopher should lay his hand on the secret of creative force and perhaps make new worlds for himself. We know not whether Elmer possessed this degree of faith in man's ultimate control over nature. He had devoted himself, however, too unreservedly to scientific studies ever to be weaned from them by any second passion. His love for his young wife might prove the stronger of the two, but it could only be by intertwining itself with his love of science and uniting the strength of the latter to his own. But it's those last sentences that I love the most, which is to say that one of the sort of central sort of questions of this piece is, what does one say about someone who loves, devotes themselves so cosmologically, so morally towards the values of science and the experimental method that it can cloud their values of love, affection, or human sort of understanding and attachment? Or as this story says, his love for his young wife might be stronger than his love of science, but only if he could make his wife a part of his love of science, which is basically what the story is about. Somebody who embodies the models of the Paris Hospital and of the experimental method that was the cornerstone of someone like Claude Bernard's work, so much so that it's now infiltrated not just the laboratory, but actually working our way backwards to the bedside, you know, his own marriage bed, if you will, with his wife. Let's look at the descriptions on the next page, page 3. This is talking about the mark on her cheek. There was a singular mark at the top of the page, deeply interwoven as it were the texture and substance of her face. And it's the shape of this mark that becomes sort of revealing. This is in the middle of page 3, and the sentence starts on the edge of the page. Its shape bore not a little similarity to the human hand, though of the smallest pygmy size. Georgiana's lovers were wont to say that some fairy at her birth hour had laid her tiny hand upon the infant's cheek and left this impress there in token of the magic endowments that were to give her such sway over all hearts. Many a desperate swain would have risked life for the privilege of pressing his lips to the mysterious hand. It must not be concealed, however, that the impression wrought by this fairy sign, Manuel varied exceedingly according to the difference of temperament in their beholders. Some fastidious persons, but they were exclusively of her sex, affirmed that the bloody hand, as they chose to call it, quite destroyed the effect of Georgiana's beauty, and rendered her countenance even hideous. But it would be as reasonable to say that one of those small blue stains which sometimes occur in the purest sanctuary marble would convert the Eve of Powers to a monster. And then it continues. So what we have here is a woman who has the small birthmark that's in the shape of the hand, and sort of interestingly, what Hawthorne has provided for us then is an age when we are seeing this notion of the patient as being one that's absolutely supposed to be interacted with, touched with in some way, and that's a cornerstone now when you interact with patients. This woman, the new wife of this young man, has by her very mark on her seemed as though she's already been touched. So one of the sort of hovering sort of themes in this story then is, what does it say for this man as a new husband having to deal with a wife and to look at her and think she's beautiful, but to feel as though in some ways, is she a virgin? Has she been defiled? Does that birthmark represent what it ultimately does for him as the one flaw on her entire visage, her entire character, if you will, to some degree? But it has a scientific and a medical sort of investment as well too, since that not only now as husband, as betrothed, but as clinician, as scientist, he's supposed to be the one that touches her. It's supposed to be his hand that leaves a mark on her in some way. And thus, his goal in this story then is to try to remove that, to try to take that away from her. What I want to look at is just a couple of moments in the story that sort of play out the stakes with which he seems to be obsessed with that particular practice. Let's see here. It was the flaw of her humanity, he calls it, on page 5. It is stated that Georgiana soon learned to shudder at his gaze, the way he looked at her. For after all, what he's looking at her now is basically, the point of this is that if she was his beautiful wife, Georgiana, now in an era in which he has become a positivist, wanting to fix and remedy things through the experimental and scientific method, and if he is one that has now adopted this gaze of looking at the symptom-based problem of the individual rather than the individual as a whole, what he has done is looked at his wife and just sort of stared at that particular sort of part of her. It's like, what's that from? It's like Austin Powers or some movie, like where somebody has a big mole. Right? He can't look beyond the symptom that's in front of him. And in his case, it pisses him off because as a husband, it makes him think that she's been defiled or something else. And two, it pisses him off because of the fact he wants to achieve perfection. So this birthmark becomes the irritation, if you will, to him both personally and professionally. The point of the story is that both personally and professionally, the ideals that he wants to live up to are almost unanimous and synonymous. And that's why the laboratory and the bedside in this story almost become fused to some degree. Let's jump ahead to page... if you're interested, on page 13 and 14, just a couple of things to direct you to historically. 13 and 14, it talks about the way that he... there's a good quote on page 12, actually, too. He knelt by his wife's side, watching her earnestly, but without alarm. for he was confident in his science and felt that he could draw a magic circle around her within which no evil might intrude. This magic circle is kind of significant too, since it speaks to the sort of like, does everybody know what I'd say when I say alchemy? You know what alchemy is? Historically? It's even a more specific kind of chemistry. Historically, it's turning things into gold.
And also like the elixir of life.
Yeah, so traditionally it means, very, very specifically, if I can take something and turn something that is not gold and turn it into gold. But more generally, it means the idea of being able to try to turn one substance into another, or to generate something from out of nothing, if you will, whether that's an elixir of life, or this human sex drive, or the fountain of youth, or whatever the hell you want to talk about, right? It's this idea that you're going to create some kind of magical propensity through the possibilities of the laboratory itself. That's why the laboratory for a long time historically had a very suspicious sort of category, because what it seemed like was the space of the charlatan, of the person that was the secularist to an extreme degree, the person that was pagan, even if you will, in some degree. We talked about clinical practice being very closely tied to theological theory for such a long time. Well, the idea of doing laboratory work would have seemed like being something of a sacrilege, not just towards religious principles, but actually towards human values. It's why, for example, this story has a strong parallel in the novel Frankenstein. So that Frankenstein, who, by the way, isn't a doctor, he went to medical school and dropped out because he didn't like it. And he didn't like it because of the fact that he wanted to read, and I'll tell you what he wanted to read. It's on page 18 in this story. Albertus Magnus, Cornelius Agrippa, Paracelsus. These are all people who worked in alchemy in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. People who tried to find elixirs of life, tried to turn things into gold, and really who liked science in the way that it almost touched on magic, who liked the laboratory. So Frankenstein leaves med school because of the fact that he's reading these authors and everyone's telling him, what the hell are you reading this shit for? You know, this is not really clinical technique that we need, you know? So he goes off, and what he does is breed a human being out of assembled parts, and thus the monster, Frankenstein. And Almer is somebody who's reading the same books, and in his case, he too is obsessed with the magical propensities that the laboratory can hold. Now, I reference this example towards Frankenstein. I mention this story by Nathaniel Hawthorne, not to just show a scientist who's endowed with these very principles that speak to the clinic and to the laboratory's important spaces, but actually to show the kind of cultural suspicion that sometimes is attached to the laboratory in this particular century because of the way in which it can seem like a isolating, dehumanizing, a kind of overemphasis on magical sort of properties. On pages 13 and 14, then, this story, as Hawthorne is prone to do, sort of lays out some of the things contemporaneously that he's interested in. So the top of page 13 is about him taking Georgiana to the laboratory and doing, like, optical illusions and using different visual techniques, like the zoetrope on her. Or on page 14, there's a description on the paragraph that starts to make up for this abortive experiment. It's a description where he talks about creating a daguerreotype. If you know what a daguerreotype is. Yeah, it's an old-fashioned photograph. If you've been to like an amusement park and they make one of those photographs on a tin plate for you, you haven't seen those tin plate pictures, that's a daguerreotype, which is to say that in itself was a laboratory-based scientific experimental advancement of the 19th century, but one that seemed to have the same propensities as this kind of alchemical sort of process. The history of photography in the 19th century is quite interesting because it's the history of the laboratory and how it's understood in scientific and in medical practice. After all, the point of photography is to take paper or tin plate or something and create an image where there wasn't one before. That very sort of like, poof, it's magic, sort of like effect is at once the thing that makes the laboratory seem suspicious, dubious, but it's also the thing that makes it seem powerful in some ways and invested in an important part of science and medicine. And this Almer character is the sort of good embodiment of that. What I'd like to turn to and sort of leave with this example is really looking at the end of the story, of what happens, the way in which he thinks science cannot fail, and the way that he becomes very invested on it. This is on page 27, and I'd like us to read from the very, very bottom of page 27 to the end, just to hear some of this language as an assessment of science and the laboratory. Can I get a volunteer or two to read for us through the end of the story? That's great. This is on where it says, "These exclamations broke Georgiana's sleep."
These exclamations broke Georgiana's sleep. She slowly unclosed her eyes and gazed into the mirror which her husband had arranged for that purpose. A faint smile flitted over her lips when she recognized how barely perceptible was now that crimson hand, which had once blazed forth with such disastrous brilliancy as to scare away all their happiness. But then her eyes sought Aylmer's face with a trouble and anxiety that he could by no means account for. "My poor Aylmer," murmured she. "Poor? Nay, richest, happiest, and most favored," exclaimed he. "My peerless bride, it is successful. You are perfect." "My poor Aylmer," she repeated, with a more than human tenderness, "you have aimed loftily. You have done nobly. Do not repent that with so high and pure a feeling you have rejected the best the earth could offer. Aylmer, dearest Aylmer, I am dying." Alas, it was too true. The fatal hand had grappled with the mystery of life and was the bond by which an angelic spirit kept itself in union with a mortal frame. As the last crimson tint of the birthmark, that sole token of human imperfection, faded from her cheek, the parting breath of the now perfect woman passed into the atmosphere, and her soul, lingering a moment near her husband, took its heavenward flight. Then a hoarse, chuckling laugh was heard again. Thus ever does the gross fatality of earth exult in its invariable triumph over the immortal essence which, in this dim sphere of half development, demands the completeness of a higher state. Yet, had Aylmer reached a profounder wisdom, he need not thus have flung away the happiness which would have woven his mortal life of the selfsame texture with the celestial. The momentary circumstance was too strong for him. He failed to look beyond the shadowy scope of time and, living once for all in eternity, to find the perfect future in the present.
Thank you. So, one of the points of this story, just speaking sort of literary-wise, is to try to think, you know, is love antithetical to science? It's sort of one of the questions it's asking. Can you be loyal to both? Can you love both the person and science? But another one is to think that the very stakes of bedside medicine, of hospital medicine, and laboratory medicine, as Jusen has described for us, is can you do good science and still respect and see the person as a full human being at the same time? That's the struggle we talk about with these bedside hospital laboratory medicine equations, is we want science to get better at treating illnesses and diseases, and we want to look more closely at where does it hurt. But can we also be mindful of what's wrong with you? Can you ask both of those questions at the same time? In this story, taking a scientist who is so invested in the principles of his age that are so prominent at the time, and pitting him next to his wife, who becomes the patient in this narrative as well, it's the test case, really, for Hawthorne. Can he love his wife and his science at the same time? And really, that question is a larger one, too, for us to think about in how we assess person versus object-oriented medicine, or hospital versus laboratory, or bedside, or whatever the kind of medicine we want to talk about. Is it possible to preserve the efficacy, to prioritize the efficacy of medicine and the humanity of it at the same time? And Jusen is right. This is why this story by Hawthorne ends, in the sense that that question is a cosmological one. It's not just a practical one. It's not just a theoretical and scientific one. It's really one that asks us to really, what is our cosmological view? What do we value? This story ends with talking about Aylmer and saying his understanding of the self-same texture with the celestial, his understandings of the scope of time, or his understanding to find the perfect future in the present. These are cosmological questions. These are questions that say what we value, what we give primacy, what we determine as being worthy of the most authentic and the most valuable sort of like estimation, whether it's faith or science, whether it's empirical interactions or whether it's the books that we read, whether it's the words that we hear from our patients or what their bodies say to us. These questions, while they seem to be distinctions in terms of how we practice medicine, are also distinctions in terms of how we have faith in medicine or not. And so all of these shifts that we're changing, and even sociologically as we go back and do these assessments, what we're actually doing and speaking to is that how medicine is practiced absolutely reveals not just how technique changes, or instruments change, or schooling changes, but actually how worldviews change, and in particular, how we determine the value of the individual as a whole person. Any questions on this? It's a small example, but I think it really exemplifies in a good way that what seems to be a specific example of a specific character in a specific story by Hawthorne is really a cosmological dilemma that's at the heart of the entire history of medicine. Let's turn to these examples that we're going to talk about today. The Flexner Report, the teaching hospital. I'd like to just direct you towards a couple of examples in this short article that I had you guys read. This is the one that's from JAMA. A short assessment of the legacy of the Flexner Report. Excuse me. And then I just kind of want to look at some of the words, that Osler recommends. How do we make the hospital the college, if you will, for med students? So a couple things to note, by the way, just to preface you about the Flexner Report. Our big dates for the Flexner Report are, let's see here, 1904, 1910. So 1904 is important because it's the year in which the American Medical Association begins their branch of CME, or the Council of Medical Education. So that suggests that at this particular time, and it's significant for us to note that the Flexner Report comes out of several different motivations, but one of those is coming from the actual American Medical Association, the begin of the CME by the AMA. So, which is to say that it's the start, not of the American Medical Association, but its branch that wants to assess, revise, and evaluate the standardization of clinical medical education. The second is 1908, which is when the Carnegie Foundation begins to fund this particular kind of assessment of medical schools, and made possible by and through the work of Abraham Flexner. Abraham Flexner was a famous scholar and educator in the very, very, very first decades of the 20th century. His work was to provide assessments of educational training in general, not just medicine. And to that degree, he was really brought on to do this report, funded by the Carnegie Foundation, in order to just really do a study of what medical schools look like in the United States and how they work. And then number 10, 1910, is the report itself, when it first comes out. It's sort of the aftermath that it leaves for us. What I want to direct you to is a couple of paragraphs in this little article to give us a sense about what are the ways in which the Flexner Report changed medicine, and what are the ways in which medicine was already changing that made possible the creation of the Flexner Report. The first I'd like to look at is on the bottom of the first column on the first page, where it states, by the turn of the 20th century, a series of scientific breakthroughs had altered the values held by the public and the medical profession. Clinical and laboratory research had exposed the irrationality of heroic treatments, such as blistering, bleeding, and purging, and had proven the therapeutic efficacy and rational scientific basis of modern practices. This is for JAMA, so it's got a lot of non-historian language in it, but I would lose the word heroic and probably say something like it removed the totalistic sort of views of treatments. Because the point about blistering and bleeding and purging was not the fact that they were heroic. The point about it is that they were all done in the service of, let me balance out your entire body in some way. I know your left side is hurting by your hip, but trust me, if I take a little bit of blood out of your right arm, it's going to alleviate the entire system. So the heroism was not the point of the practice. The point about it was that it was totalistic. So the movement away from the totalistic treatments, you can cross out the word irrationality if you want to, by the way. After all, the point is not that they were irrational in what they were doing, but they had a different sense of ration and reason for the work they were doing. And that the therapeutic efficacy had changed because of not just modern practices, but scientific ones, absolutely. A scientific method that was looking more precision, statistically, and in vision, if you will, at a particular injury. So we have here, most of the public and virtually all physicians now believed in the superiority of scientific medicine. Or I would say, the necessity of scientific medicine. Educators at leading U.S. medical schools now contended that the path toward mastering the analytic skills required to practice scientific medicine lay not with the memorization of accepted truths, but with the systematic application of the scientific method throughout medical training. That's it. Absolutely accurate sentence. They asserted that students should spend most of their time at medical school actively engaged in laboratory experimentation and hands-on care at the bedside. And those are the two branches that we're talking about. There is still lecture, and there is still anatomical theater, and there is still studying and exams and stuff like that. But the core principles and places are, and this is why it's true, that one didn't supplant the other. These are the cornerstones of medical school education at the dawn of the 20th century, at the last decades of the 19th century. And they're made possible in large part by hospitals and medical schools in Germany. These same German hospitals and medical schools that inspired someone like Claude Bernard in the first part of the 19th century to start doing more animal experimentation and to embrace the scientific method. This practice takes its next stage, though, in the way that there's the founding in America, then, of Johns Hopkins University in particular, but a couple of other medical schools following this model that want to live up to this German standard of the laboratory and the hospital as central places of training and learning, and in the service of the fact that to become a good clinician is also to become a good researcher. There's a lot of debate in the United States about what is the first university in the United States. And does anybody want to guess what the answers to those questions are? We all probably have heard. What's the oldest college in the United States?
Harvard.
Harvard is often said, because it is. It was the first college founded. William & Mary is sometimes isolated as the oldest, too, because it's continuously been open. And in some ways, it never shut its doors, even though Harvard did for 2 weeks in 1712 or something like that, right? So William & Mary is sometimes called. Penn is sometimes called the oldest university in the country because it's actually the first place to offer graduate degrees. It's the first place to have a medical school in the United States. So Penn is really the first university as opposed to a college. Johns Hopkins is also one that is called the first university in the United States. Now, Johns Hopkins wasn't founded until like 1880, 1885, something like that. Now, there were a lot of colleges and universities in the United States by then, so why the hell would we say Johns Hopkins was the oldest university? Because it was the first research university in the United States. It was the first place that felt that, not just in medicine, but in all disciplines, you can't really learn a subject unless you research on it at the same time. And you can't really learn from anybody at a university unless those professors and scholars that you're learning from are people who themselves are actively engaged in the creation of new knowledge. And that's significant. In fact, that's the standard at every university now in the United States and pretty much throughout the world, that if you're an academics and you want to get a job someplace as a professor, good luck doing it if you're not actually doing scholarship at the same time too. Well, Hopkins was the place that really fostered that standard in the United States, bringing it over from Germany in terms of medical practice specifically. So that emphasis on the research hospital becomes important because what it's trying to suggest then is that if Paris Medicine said that we need to have people trained in proximity to a clinic, then the German model said that absolutely they don't need to be in proximity, but it needs to be in the hospital, so that the name of the hospital and the name of the med school are the same name, the same institution. But we need to teach them laboratory medicine as well, too. Then Hopkins and other schools that followed suit, particularly after the Flexner Report, took that model and tried to proliferate it in a much more standardized and uniform sort of way, in a broad scale. And this is where the Flexner Report comes in. Comes in the first decade, a couple of years, I would say 15, 20 years after Hopkins is founded, but at a time when there has long been a desire to see medical education and medical practice change, a movement towards hospital and laboratory medicine that even we can see by Jussen is happening before 1870, and that it's happening at a time at the dawn of the 20th century when America's political status has significantly changed since the 19th century. We are no longer embroiled in the Civil War, although there's certainly repercussions from it. We are no longer the 50th banana on the international totem pole, so to speak. And it's about seeing America as being a leader in how different forms of political and intellectual practice are being done. And funded by the Rockefeller Center, the Carnegie Foundation, and for the service of improving medical schools, it's about trying to make medical schools in the United States be at the best quality of the best ones in the States, but in a model that also is a standard for internationally other medical schools. To that end, what it is in some ways a standardization, but really it's about an elevation of American medical education. Not that it was invented in America, but rather that it was made uniform in America is the point of the Flexner Report. To that end, the point of the report, and this is where we mentioned what its intentions were versus what it delivered, was to create a uniformity in the standard of education and training, and therefore, by extension, care that patients could get throughout the country from the medical schools. To that end, it was, if we get rid of bad medical schools and bad curriculum, then we can actually get rid of bad medicine at the same time of practice. So let's look at a couple of the details and stats that are mentioned in here. The first is on the bottom of the second column on the first page. Over the course of 18 months, Flexner visited all 155 U.S. medical schools. He examined five principal areas at each school: entrance exams, size and training of the faculty, size of endowment and tuition, quality of laboratories, and availability of a teaching hospital whose physicians and surgeons would serve as clinical teachers. Now, I mentioned this as a little pause, I'm going to continue reading in a second. If you read any of these best medical schools in the United States reports today, and U.S. News and World Report, or Times, Gallup poll, or whatever like that, They've got about 20 categories, but they all pretty much fall under these same ones. How hard is it to get in? How close is it in proximity to the hospital? What is the kind of rubric that's happening? What is the endowment that's available for improvements down the line? So in some ways, the Flexner Report is significant, not just for how it changed medical schools, but in particular that it almost invented the idea of ranking schools at all. To that degree, it's a good thing, right, in the sense that it lives and beholds certain schools up to a standard. But we all also know that rankings can be bullshit sometimes, too. So it's this idea that it renders palatable and simplified how we can evaluate schools, but it also, in that sense, has a negative effect as well. Flexner's report showed that although most of the nation's medical schools claimed to adhere to progressive scientific principles of medical education, only a very few had the financial resources, laboratory and hospital facilities, and highly skilled teaching staff necessary to apply this demanding form of education. Flexner noted, "We have indeed in America medical practitioners not inferior to the best elsewhere, but there is probably no other country in the world in which there is so great a distance and so fatal a difference between the best, the average, and the worst." And as we will find, the solution of the Flexner report was, let's get rid of the worst, let's improve some of the average, and get rid of most of them, and let's keep the best. Which is to say that we started with 155 medical schools when this report was first done. And by the time it's left its wake, there's going to be only a handful left. He maintained that to standardize the quality of all medical schools so that America's best schools, the nation must stop wasting its social and economic resources on financially strapped commercial schools that were unable to provide the costly, time-consuming, economically unprofitable ideal standard of medical education being offered at the leading U.S. medical schools. The point now to aim at is the development of the requisite number of properly supported institutions and the speedy demise of all others. In other words, one of the important words here is to get rid of the profitable part of this. It's hard to find a reputable university in the United States or in much of the world now that doesn't at least claim to be a nonprofit. The point of it being that there's not only something suspicious, but it suggests that one's eye is on a different prize when one is running with a profitable institution. So one of the major effects of the Flexner Report was to do away with for-profit medical schools that were giving, that didn't have an endowment. That's a big reason why they focus on endowment in these particular sort of evaluations of colleges and universities, and didn't have the financial resources to lean on to sustain themselves without having to lower their standard, which to bring in students or to change curricular sort of requirements for the purposes of maintaining a profitable sort of like agenda. Now what ends up happening then, of course, as a result of this is that major medical schools are shutting down in the United States because of this, that the ones that are the best are therefore influencing others to live up to a particular standard, and that it's significantly changing, in some ways, what have been long-standing sort of desires, rumblings in medicine. A hard part about this is that, if you notice, the report that's mentioned that it's supposed to bring medical schools in the United States up to a progressive, current standard that doesn't rely on reading old hat knowledge. Now, the point that we need to note is that, we talked about this semester long, is that Paris medicine was at the very end of the 19th century, and now we're at the very beginning of the 20th. That if we've gone on for centuries where the cornerstone of medicine was what has been passed on to you of learning as being most important, and it's really only over the course of the 19th century that we have worked through that very difficult struggle between how much do we preserve, how much is valuable in the present, what is significant empirical versus what is significant in the, what I've learned from a book or from some scholarship, classical or antithetical or ancestral. If that century is having us work it out, the Flexner Report is significant because it suggests a new agenda in the 20th century, but it also suggests chastisement for those institutions and teachers and curriculums that haven't quite caught up yet. To that degree, it sounds like it's sad that there could be medical schools that weren't contemporary in their laboratory, hospital, scientific training at that time. But at the same time, it's not surprising, if you ask me, that given a discipline that changed so dramatically over the course of 100 years in the 19th century, that we would get to the dawn of the 20th century and still see remnants of how the profession had been run for centuries and centuries before. It doesn't surprise me, you know? And yet, the Flexner Report, an age of dramatic transformation in a country like the United States, where it was happening more swiftly than anywhere at this time, it was there where we're not going to tolerate not being up to speed. And so therefore, we don't care if we have to shut down medical schools left and right. And that's what happened. And what happened? Medical schools in the United States got dramatically faster and dramatically better than anywhere else in almost no time. Such that if the Edinburgh School, if Paris medicine, if German medicine were all standards in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, and longstanding. They still are in the 20th century, but by God, if American medical schools aren't in the next 2 decades after the Flexner Report becoming, according to these rankings, the number 2, 4, 7, 9, 10, 12, 14, 15, 20, 22, 24, 28 number of medical schools in the world, like that. Because they basically took what was, said this is where the bar is, if this is not the bar you reach, you are being shut down, and everybody just has to play that game. And so what happened was much fewer medical schools, much better medical schools, but also repercussions in terms of who's left out of those medical schools.
Is your hand up? Yeah, it's actually in here. I just was wondering who took the authority to close down the schools.
Yeah.
It's the licensing boards?
Yeah, the licensing board. It's made possible by this right here, which is to say, we tend to think of the Flexner Report as the site of agency that made possible the shutting down of medical schools. Or we think it's the Carnegie Foundation, which funded it, that made possible. But I think it's actually the creation by the American Medical Association of the sense that a standardization at all was going to become a prerequisite. It made possible the Carnegie's interest, and then therefore made possible the Flexner Report, but it was the enforcement of the report itself by the American Medical Association that really sort of set forward this particular effect of the Flexner Report. Yeah? If you look at the bottom of the last two paragraphs of the entire article, I just kind of want to read them out loud because I think they give us a sense about what we mean about, again, this is another example. The Flexner Report is just like what Jusen talks about here. The Flexner Report absolutely made medical schools better in the sense that they made training more comprehensive and longer. There were plenty of medical schools at that time that you could walk in and walk out with an MD in like 18 months, you know, and maybe never even had to step onto a ward or seen a patient once, you know. One would like to think, I'm glad they got rid of those, you know what I mean? Having said that, the betterness of what the Flexner Report also left some things not so better. So how we define better is significant. Laboratory and hospital medicine improved a lot of the epidemiological and clinical practice. It also got rid of some things that weren't so better. Patient interaction, humanity, voice, agency in the clinic. The Flexner Report also had some ramifications, and these are listed at the end. Although these reforms raised the quality of medical education in the United States, it concurrently caused a disproportionate reduction in the number of physicians serving disadvantaged communities. Most small rural medical colleges and all but 2 African-American medical colleges were forced to close, leaving in their wake impoverished areas with far too few physicians. Furthermore, the increased entrance requirements and extended course of study now required to become a physician promoted professional elitism and inhibited the economically and underprivileged from pursuing careers in medicine. Medical schools continue to struggle to overcome these untoward effects of the standardization of American medical education. To the present day, all accredited U.S. medical schools strive to apply Flexner's uniformly arduous and expensive brand of medical education. Though the rising costs of healthcare have forced many schools to make curricular compromises and to form corporate alliances as they attempt to balance academic ideals with economic and social responsibilities. So the repercussions that it had very much so on the number of schools and therefore the number of patients could be treated were significant. It's the African-American part of medical schools that perhaps is the biggest significant impact in the sense that there were dozens of them up until the start of the effects of the Flexner Report, and as it says, there were only 2 that were left. I think today there might only be 2 or 3 that are historically black medical schools in the United States. To that end, on the one hand, those reports, those schools weren't living up to this very high standard that those other schools were, but we could certainly account for 1,000 sociological reasons for why they weren't. They didn't have the funding, they were for black people at the time, and therefore probably didn't get first dibs at the best scientists and the best materials. They were also having to speak to communities that were impoverished and poor quite often rather than the most elite and best of patients. I'm sure they didn't have an endowment if that was a requirement to some degree. And yet, we also know that the standard of care might have done it as well either. So there are pros and cons. There are attributes and there are also detriments to the way the report like this has had an effect. And the point of this little piece, I think it's nice at the end, is to say that we see ramifications and repercussions of this Flexner Report even today in terms of medical schools trying to live up to the standardization. And I mentioned those medical school reports on what's the best medical school and that comes out every year because they're all still trying to live up to that extremely high standard, that expensive, that thorough, but that very historically loaded standard that has absolutely historically invested and practical and epidemiologically rational sort of ways in which the hospital and the laboratory and training and patient interaction are central to the viability and the value of a hospital, a teaching hospital, but also are ones that in their wake also leave a lot of patients and the profession itself being asked, is it more elitist or is it less? integrating the hospital with the medical school? Have we united patient care with patient clinical training? Or have we made it less capable because of the way that it is so expensive and much harder to perform? Is it a testament to American ideals, or is it in some ways the opposite of that for its particular age? The last thing I want to do is just direct you towards a couple passages in this speech by William Osler. It's a nice breakdown, actually, in this piece about what he was talking about in his specific moment. This piece, by the way, is from, I think it says at the bottom, 04, is that right? 03. So this is being written just prior to this entire history of the Flexner Report, but by God, if Hopkins isn't already living up to that standard. In other words, this piece by William Osler is delivered and written at a time just prior to the AMA's revisions, the Carnegie's getting invested in, and the Flexner Report being printed, such that what Osler is talking about is a standard that he's trying to sell that hasn't yet been adopted by either the American Medical Association or the Flexner Study or any of the medical schools since. And so it's providing an almost romanticized sort of portrait of what the ideal should be. We know in hindsight, though, that this ideal that he's proposing is actually going to become the standard for medical schools in the long sense. So I would have you take a look at, it's on pages 281 and 282, where he breaks down the way he systematically wants to see third and fourth year med students taught in their undergrad curriculums. And in particular, how he sees the tension between what an old and a new method would look like in this particular training. And the last thing I would say is to look at the last two paragraphs of this entire speech, not just because of the fact that he sort of reiterates some of the key tenets that are central to a third and fourth year medical student's education, and in particular the relationship to the hospital. And by the way, this is an era where some medical schools would have been like, what do you mean third and fourth year medical school? You know what I mean? So that in itself is a sort of big call. But also the stakes with which he sees this as an important model, not just for the present of medicine, but in the name of the victory of the history of medicine as well. Osler himself is a big historian of medicine. So I'm just going to read to you the last couple sentences of this article, and you can hear how significant it is for him, a revision of the medical school and the invocation of the hospital is. He says, better work is done for the profession and for the public. The practical education of young men who carry with them to all parts of the country good methods extends enormously the work of an institution, and the profession is recruited by men who have been taught to think and to observe for themselves, and who become independent practitioners of the new school of scientific medicine. This is the research university he's talking about. Men whose faith in the possibilities of their art has been strengthened, not weakened, by a knowledge of its limitations. This is the experimental method he's talking about. It is no new method which I advocate, but the old method of Boerhaave, of the elder Rutherford of the Edinburgh School, of the older men of this city and of Boston and Philadelphia. Now you can see he's making this into an American mantra. The men who had been pupils of John Hunter and of Rutherford and of Saunders. It makes of the hospital a college in which, as clinical clerks and surgical dressers, the students slowly learn for themselves, under skilled direction, the phenomena of disease. It is the true method, because it is the natural one, the only one by which a physician grows in clinical wisdom after he begins practice for himself. All others are bastard substitutes. Thanks, everybody. Next week, we're going to talk about eugenics and wrap up with a little bioethics summation. Thanks.